My name is Adil Raja. I'm an ex-military officer. I've served for 21 years in the Pakistan Army. I've served with the British Army. I've served with the US Army. It's Afghanistan. I was a fighting arm officer. So military is a way of life in Pakistan because there are not many opportunities there. But for me, it was like I was a third generation Pakistan Army officer. So, and my family is British Pakistani. Half of my family settled here. My mom was here. We migrated here to the UK in Southwest London in the early 60s. So, but that's my maternal family. My paternal family was always there. My great grandfather was in the Royal Indian Army and he fought the First World War. I mean, at that time it used to be the Army of the East India Company. Then my granddad, he was a colonel. He took commission from the Royal Indian Army and he fought the Second World War. And then my dad took commission in early 70s, in fact, in 1970. And, well, I was born in 1978. And once I grew up, all I knew was army, military, you know, because I'd seen my dad, my granddad, my great-granddad. So I wanted to join the army and I wanted to join the fighting arm. And what is a fighting arm? Basically, I was in the armored corps, the tank regiments. And that is a glamorous life as well, you know, driving tanks. And you put that sticker behind your car, that caution, I drive tanks. It's supposed to be a very macho stuff. And it used to appeal me at that age. Imagine that, you know, a youngster looking for the black uniform and the black beret. And, you know, that was a glamorous life back then because what I saw my dad, after my dad took commission in 1971, and that was the last war which we had fought at that time. So I considered the life to be a glamorous one. The military life hasn't got much money into it, but it has always got the kind of charm if you're looking for it. And at that particular era, I'm talking about 1996, once I joined the Pakistan Army, it was supposed to be a glamorous job, you know. I used to come to the UK, I would go visit the British Army, different places of the British Army as well, because the British Army and the Pakistan Army are affiliated ever since they were part of the colonial rule, you know.
I wonder if I could, sorry to interrupt you, but can you just give us an idea of what attitudes are like to the British in Pakistan? Because obviously, you know, with India too, and many of the other colonies, you know, it was a kind of, the British were using that part of the world. They were extracting resources. And so I wonder with your parents and grandparents' generation and the modern generations, what is the actual attitude towards the British?
You see, if you talk about the civilians, they believe whatsoever you're saying, and now I believe the same. But the British, the Pakistan was a colony. But as far as India is concerned, subcontinent got partitioned into Pakistan and India, and now later on, 71, Bangladesh took freedom. That's why East Pakistan became an independent country. But the problem with the difference between India and Pakistan is that Pakistan stayed with its roots of the British Army, whereas Indians, they, you know, evolved themselves into, we call it the saffronization of Indian Army. So they went back to their roots and they, you know, really went into the Hindutva. They took upon the political philosophy of Hindutva, from Hindu religion, Hindu mythology, and they charted a path for themselves, which was quite different because in the Cold War, there were two main camps, you know that, the USA and the USSR. So India remained non-aligned, but all their defense equipment came from the USSR and now comes from Russia. So they were more inclined toward the Russian camp, the USSR camp, you know. So the Pakistani stayed with the American and the UK camp. And the American always handled the Pakistan Army through the UK. So Pakistanis always maintained the traditional ties with the Crown and with the British Army. And, by doing so, India always had democracy. and the Indians made sure that the military do not interfere in their democracy. They started making laws and checks and balances in the 1950s, starting because 1947 was a partition, they took independence. So they started in the 1950s. They could foresee that if they do not do that, there would be a day once the Indian Army would take over on behalf of the Royal British Army, and they'll remain a colony, much like Pakistan, because Pakistan remained a colony because the founder of Pakistan, he could not survive. Jinnah, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, could not survive for long, and there's a conspiracy that he was killed. He was not provided with an ambulance, but to be fair, he had the fourth stage cancer and he was not going to survive for much longer anyway. But starting that time, the Pakistanis, after the Second World War, went in the Western camp, in the American camp. And the Americans had a direct relationship, but they always managed the Pakistani military, Pakistani army, through the British army, through the British establishment, and they're doing it up till now. I mean, it's been like, what, 75 years later, we are still doing the same. And by doing that, the Pakistani military holds the reins of power in Pakistan. They are the actual power brokers in Pakistan. So by extension of the Pakistan army, the British army is extending the influence, extending the U.S. influence to Pakistan, but they are still, you know, they've got a say in the power corridors. They've got a lot of, you know, clout there because of the Pakistan army, because of the association they've always kept with the Pakistan army. Yeah.
So before we get to looking at, you know, this relationship with the politics in Pakistan versus the military, can you just explain, you know, how you got on in the military, how you came to the UK, that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, as I told you, my maternal family was they were living in the UK starting from early 60s, right? And my mum was here, my grandmum was here, and my entire family was here. So I got married to my wife Sabine, who is born and brought up in the UK. Her grandparents also came in the early 50s, so they got settled there. Her mum was here. I mean, and she's a graduate alumni of the London School of Economics. She did her LLM in human rights from there. So there was a lot of, in the Pakistan Army, because of the background I've told you, there are only three countries in which the Pakistan Army officers are allowed to marry the foreign national. You're allowed to marry a foreign national of US, UK, and the third country is Australia. But even for that, you need to take the permission of the Chief of Army Staff. So I took permission from my Chief of Army Staff and I married Sabine. So I established a connection with the UK. So I was already coming to meet my grandma, and I was already coming to meet my uncles and family here, even once I was serving. But then I got married to a British girl. So that was my connection with the UK. And that is why I always had an option open to me to, you know, move to the UK. But I joined the army because I was a third generation. I really didn't, you know, I like the glamour of wearing the black uniform, the black cap. I mean, what do you expect from a 17, 18 year old kid, man? That's when I joined it. And the glamour, but because of the glamour, I went in. But I took commission in 1999, and 1999 is the year when the Kargil War happened. So we passed out, took commission, and straight away, you know, we went to the Kargil War with India. But that was a short-lived war. But later on, soon after Kargil, a new kind of war started. That was called the War Within, which you guys call the Global War Against Terror, you know, so-called Global War Against Terror, because I took commission in 1999 and 2001, 9/11 happened, and everything changed for us. Everything changed overnight. You know, till the 80s, we made the Mujahideen, we trained them with the CIA, we launched them against the USSR, and then when the job was done, USSR got broken, and the 80s, well, the Yanks packed up everything and they went back, and they never turned to look back at what's happening in Afghanistan. Whereas a lot of resentment was there in Afghanistan, and then Al-Qaeda came in. They were part of the Afghan Jihad, which was being funded by the CIA and ISI, the Pakistani intelligence. So they were basically children of this Western war against the USSR. So, but 9/11 happened, and then the focus again shifted back to Afghanistan and Pakistan. You know, they called it AFPAC, Afghanistan, Pakistan, which is, I think, an insult, because there are a lot of difference. The dynamics are very different between both the countries, but there are shared tribe, divided tribes. Later on, we can discuss it someday. But I'm talking about myself personally. The global war against terror, which we call the war within, started. So I went there for the glamour, but as soon as I took commission, that was the Kargil War. And then there was the war within, which I kept on fighting till the time I took voluntary retirement in 2017. I went to one war zone after another war zone after another war zone. And I survived three IED attacks on myself, one suicide attack on myself in September 2010. I got wounded, became a war wounded officer. I suffered post-traumatic stress disorder because the bloodshed, it was really crazy. I used to even dream, you know, putting my mates in their graves, because the amount of funerals I had to attend on almost every day, that will, you know, that really had an impact on you. And the war was really bloody. You never knew who's your enemy, who's your friend. You could not differentiate between friend and foe. Even you are fighting in your own country, your own people. Once you go to Afghanistan, there are divided tribes in Pakistan and Afghanistan. One brother's living there, one brother's living here. So it's very difficult for you to, you know, differentiate who's friend and who's a foe. So a lot of mistakes happen, collateral damages happen, a lot of tragedy occurs, and that impacts you definitely once you lose your mates in that war. That impacts you. And then the Pakistani clergy at that time declared that this war was, that was un-Islamic, that was against, you know, you were fighting against your own people, and, you know, that kind of things. I had my men killed in battle, and I'll take their dead bodies to their hometowns. And, you know, the clergy over there, the mullahs, they won't offer their funeral prayer. They'll say, well, we can't, because he's been fighting his own people. Anyway, things did get changed when Musharraf was there. And even after that, things did get changed.
Let me just also ask you about this. I mean, some commentators have said that actually what was going on with the war on terror, that bin Laden really had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. And this was really like an American playground in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yeah, well, that is, I've heard the theory too, that bin Laden just took the advantage of it. But what I learned on ground was that he was definitely involved, but his involvement was very well known to certain group of people in the US who allowed it to happen, or let's say US allies who allowed it to happen, and a certain the intelligence community definitely knew that was going to happen, and they let it happen. And then, of course, Michael Moore made the Fahrenheit 9/11, and then the conspiracy theories came in. But it's definitely not what it seems at the face of it. Because of that so-called global war on terror, the entire world changed. And of course, they came at. I've just finished a book called Call Sign Chaos by Jim Mattis, and there is another book by Fairweather, The Good War. It's about Afghanistan. So you'll just learn that as far as Pakistan and Afghanistan was concerned, the Pakistani played a double game with the Americans. They made money off it, all right? They never trusted the Americans because they said that they can leave us at any time. At the same time, they were benefiting from the so-called coalition support fund. You know, there's a rent-seeking attitude in Pakistan. So they were getting their rent. But overall, the war was never won in Afghanistan. The Americans lost a lot of, money, trillions of dollars, men, especially men. The British Army lost a lot of money and a lot of men there. And I was just reading these books, a couple of books, and in the Helmand province of Afghanistan, the British Army really got got a beating, and they've made movies about it. So a lot of people who've seen those movies know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, there's also a lot of credible sources that say that much of this was about drugs, and that even speaking to some of the soldiers coming back, the British soldiers coming back, they're saying they spent quite a lot of their time guarding areas that they either later or even after they come back home found out were drug growing areas, opium.
Yeah, well, Tony, it's funny that you ask. Yeah, you know, but the entire business of running militias, opposing factions required a lot of money, and there were a lot of clandestine operation, black ops, and under the garb of the black ops, and the Americans or the coalition forces empowered the warlords in Afghanistan, and the warlords, they were patronizing the drug trade. And at that time, I mean, almost the major share of drugs in the world was being, prepared at Afghanistan, and then they used to be smuggled to Pakistan. From there, they used to be smuggled to, and then CIA was involved in it. They've written books about it, by the way. ISI was involved in Pakistan. Then it used to go to Iran, and the Iranian Republican Guard Corps intelligence organization. I mean, they made an intelligence organization later on, but the Quds force was involved and giving safe passage up to Turkey. And from Turkey, it'll go into Europe and to the rest of the world. Yeah, that's a fact. That's not a myth. There were drugs going up. And the British Army were not protecting the poppy fields. They tried to destroy it. But there was so much and so many of it that you really can't do nothing much about it. And then you are protecting the warlords, which you have erected, which you are trying to make the kingmakers. Whereas they're, in fact, the drug lords, not the warlords. So you, indirectly, you're protecting the drug lords. So,
well, the irony here is that the most effective at suppressing the growth of the poppies and opium were the Taliban.
Yeah, that's true, actually. But the Taliban were, till the time they were in the opposition, they were making money. They were living tax on drug trade. Now, once they are in power, they've kicked all the drug lords out from Afghanistan into Pakistan, and now they're in Balochistan province, where today, there's a terrorist incident where a train filled with 426 passengers were hijacked, and about 200 military personnel were in it going on leave. So,
yeah. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that. From your point of view, what's been going on there? We've just heard that the hostages, the Pakistan army people, have been released. I'm sure you'll be very glad to hear.
Yeah, well, that's all part of... No, that's not true, actually. The war is still going on. I've got the exact figures as of 2 hours ago, and we are recording it on the night of the 12th March. The latest figures is that there were total 426 passengers in the train, out of which 214 were serving military personnel. 212 civilians were released by the insurgents, and then 40 were killed at the spot, and 60 were later on killed. About 100 were killed, and then 150 are still hostage, and they have freed around 60 soldiers out of them, but still there are officers and there are senior members of the military. They're still hostage with them, and they want to trade them with the people.
This is horrifying, isn't it? But can you tell us a bit about the Balochistan Liberation Army? Who are these people? Who's really running things there, and what are they fighting for?
Yeah, well, they want a separate country for themselves. And it is, we're talking about 44% landmass of Pakistan. It's just as of today, in the UK, the Scots say that we want to break free. And that's 33% landmass. Maybe not a big population, only 8% of the UK. Likewise, the Baloch are only like 8%, around about 7 to 8% of Pakistan. But the land mass is huge. The mineral wealth is huge. And they've always been mistreated by the Pakistani. The Pakistani military is Punjab-centric, because Punjab is the population hub of the country. So that is why the Punjab-centric policies are being implemented, and it's like a colony. The rights have not been given, and once they were being given, they were being given by the local lords, or the local sardars, as we call them. They're the local lords. colonial system still going on, tribal system still going on, but now the youngsters, they're very well educated people. They have really, you know, taken over the charge, because in the last 5 decades, their parents, their brothers, they've been kidnapped and made turned into missing person. There are around 10,000 missing persons abducted by the Pakistani military, killed extrajudiciously, because there's a series of rebellion in Balochistan, and it was always a political problem there, but because of the mineral wealth of Balochistan, there are mountains of gold, and I'm not just saying it. Tatayan companies involved in extracting gold worth around $200 billion. That's $200 billion. I'm telling you about. So there are mountains of gold. There are huge reserves of copper, which the Chinese are extracting for about 30 years now. They take the copper ore, they process it in China, take the gold out, and then, you know, give some shillings out of a pound to the local population. So the local population are suffering for a long time. They've been asking for their rights. They don't have the basic necessities of life. They don't have running water, electricity, or, you know, medical facilities. Whereas the wealth of their land has been extracted by the Federation of Pakistan, which is Punjab-centric. So that
well,
is
hang on, because you're sounding to me a bit like a kind of spokesperson for the Balochistan Liberation Army. You're making their case for them. So what's happened politically? How come they're not being listened to?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It was always a political problem, and I never realized it till the time I had to suffer. And in fact, my mates, I'm a Punjabi myself, and my mates in the army and my, you know, colleagues, they also never understood the problem until 3 years ago in 2022, a regime change operation happened against Imran Khan, and the kind of suppression and the kind of fascism which was being enforced upon Balochistan, that was enforced universally upon the rest of Pakistan, in Punjab even. People's mums were abducted, like my mum was abducted, because I was supporting Imran Khan. I had to flee the country in 2022, and I had taken voluntary retirement in 2017, by the way. So I had, with full honors and awards, I was court-martialed in absentia for speaking up about these atrocities, for supporting Imran Khan, who's a cricketing legend as well, and who wants civilian supremacy. That's what he wanted. But the military...
Well, let's just be clear about that, because that there has always been, and of course there is in many countries, a rivalry, as there used to be back in medieval times, between the church and state. Now it's often between the military and the state. So can you just put into context what's been going on with Imran Khan? I think many listeners will have seen him appearing on the news from time to time, prime minister, and then, you know, it's exciting when he becomes prime minister, someone that many people know and recognize. But suddenly he's behind bars. So can you just take us through that whole process?
Yeah. So in Pakistan, the way system works is that, the state and clergy, the church and clergy, like in our case, it is the mullahcracy. The mullahcracy, it's a mix of mullah and bureaucracy. We call it mullahcracy. The mullahcracy and the state works together, and the state is dominated by the military. The army chief has empowered himself starting from 1950s. They brought in a clause in the constitution of Pakistan called Article 199, Clause 3, which empowers the army chief to, you know, just simply dismiss any officer or any man of the armed forces if he doesn't agree with them under an administrative action, and they cannot even, you know, go to any employment tribunal, or they cannot even complain about it, or they cannot go even to the High Court, right? But as per the Constitution, the chief have been made a power. And because of that, Field Marshal Ayub Khan, you know, he ruled the country for the initial around about up till the 70s, late 60s. He ruled the country starting from 1950. Then it was Yahya Khan who broke half the country. Then it was Bhutto was hanged, and Zia-ul-Haq came. And Zia-ul-Haq's era, combined with the jihad created by, if you've seen you know, this if you've seen this, there's a very famous movie called Charlie Wilson's War. Charlie Wilson was a congressman and who was, you know, in the Senate's Arms Committee, and he was giving millions and millions and millions of dollars to CIA, and the money was being funneled to the ISI, and that's how they got rich. And that's how the Mullahcracy, who used to ride bicycles, started rising Land Cruisers and started rising SUVs, and they became really rich, and the Pakistani generals became really rich. And that is from where the Jihad era brought a grand alliance between the Mullahs and the Pakistani military, and that alliance is still there. It only did get disturbed when General Musharraf was there, and Musharraf was with this theory of enlightened moderation, and he ruled the country for 11 years. Most of the time in Pakistan's existence, it has been ruled, 70% of the time it has been ruled by the military dictators. So that's really give them a lot of power, and they've been supported by the British establishment, I mean, because they were, had links with the British establishment, British army, and they maintained those colonial links. Our regiments, we maintained our links with the British ancestry, because that's the parent army. So we maintain those links, you know. But Imran Khan was trying to change the entire configuration. He came into power in 2018, and he was trying to work for the civilian supremacy. So they hatched the plan for him, and they sent him to Russia just before Russia invaded Ukraine. Just imagine that. The Imran Khan was in Moscow. It was his third day there when Putin was meeting him, and there was breaking news going on that Russian forces had invaded Crimea, and they had invaded Ukraine. Yeah, so I don't exactly remember, was it Crimea or was it Ukraine, but he had invaded. And then the Pakistani general sent out a message to Washington D.C. to listen, this guy. Just before going to Moscow, the CIA director, he came to Islamabad, and he wanted to meet Imran Khan. And he said, no, I'm not going to meet you. Meet my intelligence chief. Why should I meet you? Now, that was an insult, you know. Director CIA is supposed to be, he's supposed to be the boss of the Pakistani generals even. So how dare he say no? And then Imran Khan, in the famous HBO interview, was asked that whether you're going to provide bases to the U.S. forces for, you know, operation in Afghanistan and Iran. And Imran Khan said, absolutely not. Now, that absolutely not really haunted Washington, D.C. And that is where the generals, they found a plan to get rid of him. And they helped him come into power. But then they told him that you need to balance out the relationship between the Eastern Bloc and the Western Bloc. So you should go to Moscow. Whereas there was all the likely intelligence available to the Pakistani ISI that they are going to invade Ukraine. And Imran Khan should have avoided going there at that particular time. But, he did went in anyway because he was advised to by his intelligence forces. And once he was there, while he was there, they attack Ukraine. Just imagine that. Now, instead of canceling his visit, he stayed on for another 2-3 days and then came back. So that was, the alarm bells rang off in Washington, D.C. And then the Pakistani generals, they collaborated with D.C. And an assistant secretary of South Asia, Donald Liu, wrote a cipher, the very famous cipher, that if you want to be on a good side, you have to get rid of Imran Khan. So that is when a vote of no confidence was arranged by the military, and Imran Khan's government was removed. But there was Imran Khan brought out the cipher, the American diplomatic cipher, because of which he faced a treason case of treason, because of which he was, he was tried under Official Secret Act. And by the way, I also got tried under the Official Secret Act. I've just come to know about this day before yesterday from the Royal Court of Justice in the UK, where I'm facing a slap legislation from the ISI itself, because I've been court-martialed in absentia. And the ISI's official has told the court that, he was court-martialed because of the violation of Official Secret Act. I never knew that, by the way, but because the court-martial was in absentia. But Imran Khan was tried for the Official Secret Act, and he was thrown into jail after the 9th of May, 2023, once he was trying to, while he was on bail before arrest, the paramilitary forces stormed in the Islamabad High Court, and they abducted him. The military simply don't care about the courts or the judicial process or the due justice system in Pakistan. And they work above board. They even put cameras in the judges, high court judges' bedrooms, and they wrote about it to the Supreme Court. They abducted the high court brother-in-law of Islamabad high court judge and tortured him because they want him to write decisions against Imran Khan. So that's how he's been, you know, put in jail with a 14-year
sentence. Crazy. Yeah. It sounds absolutely crazy to me. But, I mean, it's not. I suppose if you want the military to be actually in charge, as they are in countries like Egypt, and other, yeah. There are others where the military just simply runs things and there isn't really any proper democracy. Yeah. I mean, the democracy is a principle. I think, you know, most soldiers even want to fight for something like that. The idea that you're fighting for not just for yourself, but for your country people, you know, other people in your own country so that they can have their say. I think that that sort of morale that comes with that kind of fighting, it is much more positive and will bring people together much more than just fighting for some, you know, the latest oligarch or the latest tyrant that wants to control the people. But anyway, did you actually, through all this process, did you actually meet Imran Khan?
Yeah, I did actually. I did meet him. I used to raise funds for him once he was making the cancer hospital named after his mom. He won the World Cup. He was our hero. So he used to come to our school in Islamabad and he asked us to raise funds. And I raised, that was the first time I met him. I was a young kid and he came to my school and I was the one who's raised the most money because, you know, I've been really bothering bugging my family, my aunts and uncles, and asking them to buy the tickets for his, you know, fundraiser. And I raised a lot of money for him. So, yeah, that was the first time I met him. Later on, once he was a prime, later on, during 2014, I was a serving officer and he came on the roads of Islamabad and he gave a sit-in for around, that was the longest sit-in in the history of Pakistani politics. It was more than 3 months. And I used to go there daily and I used to see him, meet him. So yeah, I knew. And once he became the prime minister in 2018, I used to go to the prime minister's house. And then later on, once he was thrown out and I had to flee the country, I used to talk to him. And we were in communication. And even from jail, I have been communicating with him. Because then once I flew the country, I mean, I got involved in journalism once I took voluntary retirement in 2017. And I started writing for The Nation, the English newspaper, and started appearing in media programs in Pakistan. And I became a spokesperson of the Pakistan Ex-Servicemen Society, which was an ISI-funded project. So, and at the same time, I was doing a very lucrative business. I was doing a real estate business. I was buying, you know, all the businesses. There's a monopoly in Pakistan on all the businesses, and the monopoly is being run by the military itself. So I was doing a very successful business with the military. So by the virtue of my business connections and right being an influencer at that time, I had that verified Twitter profile in 2021. And at that time, you could not buy, the blue tick was not supposed to be bought. It used to be given to notables. So I was, you know, an influencer within the military. That's what got me in trouble. Now, that's really, you know, important. That's what got me in trouble because I opposed this regime change operation against Imran Khan. And I spoke against it and I exposed the entire episode because the previous army chief, General Bajwa, he came to talk to us and he said, so what? I removed him. And he boosted about it, you know, and he was, you know, he is like that. He's kind of, he's got that kind of a personality. He wants to take credit even where he should not, but you know, he's not very subtle like that. So he exposed himself and he said that, well, yeah, I have removed Imran Khan. I had to remove him. There were strategic compulsions, blah, blah, blah. And I made it public through my Twitter profile. And that really, you know, broke loose after that. I was reprimanded by the general headquarters. I was called by the ISI, by the military intelligence. And well, but, you know, I deleted that tweet. But it didn't stop me. And that's when the ISI raided my house, my mom's house. And they came in. But and the next day I went to General Bajwa's father-in-law. He was also a retired general. He was a godfather. I asked him that, listen, why are you? Because he's the man who's the kingmaker, who was the kingmaker. So I and me being a third generation officer, I knew who's who. and which handle, and by the virtue of my business and my position as a spokesperson, I knew who do I need to see. So I went, I met him, I said, "Sir, why are you doing this?" And he said, "Well, there are a lot of complaints about you and you're not behaving. You have to, you know, tag along with us." I said, "Listen, I said, I cannot tag along with you. I'll stay shut because you're powerful. I understand that. And I can't really, you know, go against you while living in Pakistan. And I won't be living anymore, practically." But no, he said, "No, you have to join forces with us and you have to speak against Imran Khan." And that is when I decided that I have to make a decision. And the same night, that was the second night in, you know, consecutively, again, the ISI and sent the gunman to my house. So, but that time I was ready because my wife and my kids were already, Sabine and my kids were already living here in London, and I was traveling already. Every second month I used to travel to London because I had to be with my kids and family. So I was shuttling between London and Islamabad anyway. So I left that night. I was supposed to go after 2 weeks to via Saudi Arabia. But I took a direct flight, via Doha. I took a flight, first available flight that night, and left the country. And I avoid being arrested. And my mother tried to leave later on, but she was abducted and her passport was taken away. My nationality, Pakistani nationality, was stripped off. And there were fictitious cases made against me, just like cases have been made against Imran Khan. And all my property was confiscated in Pakistan. My bank account balances were confiscated. My pensions were confiscated. My house were confiscated. But I knew the choice I was making. I knew it's a tough choice. I knew I'll have to fight. I asked my wife, Sabine. She's a brave, brave girl, I tell you. I told her that this, if I'm going to go this path, then we're going to get into a lot of trouble. You know, forget about traveling business class and, you know, enjoying your life. And you know, then we'll be again hand to mouth. And I'll be in a lot of trouble because I had not planned for anything like that. So she said, well, she herself is a warrior clan. She's got Persian warrior blood in her. She said, and she believes in that kind of stuff. She made me believe in it that, well, if you were a warrior breed, then you fight on. And if you're fighting on the right side of history for the right kind of cause, then no matter the consequences, you need to fight. And that was not only my wife before her, my mom taught me the same. So I fought back. I fought back and I paid the price and I'm still fighting back. And even in the UK, they didn't spare me. They got me arrested here by the counterterrorism police. And for 9 months, they made me go under an intense investigation under the counterterrorism law, found nothing, ended with no further action. And then the ISI itself came after me and, you know, went for a slap legislation since UK is the libel tourism capital of the world. They went to, and they've got no shortage of money. The state of Pakistan, of course, is you can't fight the state, but I'm fighting it. The ISI came after me with a slap legislation, and I'm still fighting it in the Royal Court of Justice. I'm supposed to go to trial in July. So, yeah, that's happening. But at the same time, amazing. I'm fighting back. Yeah, I'm fighting back.
So, who do you think? I mean, it's obviously the military in Pakistan can't really do this on its own. Who are at which countries and who from outside is helping? Is kind of egging them on, because I mean it's well known, isn't it, that both India and Pakistan do have nuclear weapons. So the control of those states, the idea is we don't want them to be independent, we don't want them switching sides and this sort of thing. So whereabouts do you think the influence is coming that's supporting from outside Pakistan what the dictators in the military are up to?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about earlier, and even right now it's very relevant. This the great power rivalry. Previously, it was between USSR and the USA, so the Pakistani military sided with the USA. And, well, it almost worked out for them, but it doesn't mean that they had not sided with the USSR. The USSR came to Karachi's port. They wanted to reach the USSR wanted to reach the warm waters, right? And the warm waters, the nearest, they had reached Afghanistan, and that's that was bordering Pakistan. Next step was Pakistan and the Arabian Sea's warm waters, and that would have given them access to the Middle East oil reserves and Middle East as well. So they made the Pakistanis, you know, struck a deal with them. And Pakistan's biggest steel mill was created by the USSR in the 70s. So they were playing both sides, even in the Cold War. So after the Cold War finished and, you know, the Yanks went back and everything, well, after before 9/11, the situation took a different turn, and the U.S. were not involved a lot. So the Chinese came in, they stepped in, and the Pakistani military went to Beijing and they sold them the idea of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which became the flagship of their Belt and Road Initiative. And they brought them in. They brought them in. And then once the Americans came back after 9/11, they said, listen, the Chinese are here. So if you want to us to counterbalance them, so you also need to get involved. And that's what they were doing once USA and USSR was there. So now they are this rent-seeking attitude I was talking about. They're taking the money, the investment from the Chinese, and they're inviting the Chinese in as well. And they're inviting the Americans to counter the Chinese influence. But the danger in this entire game is that India is now is a growing economy as well. And India is now not in a strategic partnership with the USSR or Russia. It's in a strategic partnership to counter China with the USA. And they are a regional power. So, again, coming back to the BLA situation, Baloch Liberation Army, the Indians are supporting them definitely because they don't want a stable Pakistan. They want, and the Chinese investments are basically in Balochistan. The Balochistan's coastal belt, they've already got Gwadar over there, and it's a deep sea port, a strategic deep sea port. Then they've just made a $250 million airport. And there are only one commercial flight, and I think per day, that's all. And that can be easily used as a Chinese PLA Air Force base. And the Chinese are now building a military base right at the border of Iran and Pakistan. It's an area called Jiwani. And they're going to bring in their fifth generation stealth fighters and their bombers over there. And they're going to station them over there. So the Chinese are militarizing the entire area. And as we speak right now, the Chinese, the Russians, and the Iranians are doing a combined naval exercises in the Arabian Sea. So the Chinese are very much there, and they're bringing in their forces. And the Pakistanis, they come to the Washington, D.C., and they talk to D.C. through London. So they come here and they say, listen, we can't do much because we don't have any money left with us. Our economy is in shambles. We are dependent on the Chinese money. At the same time, the American money through IMF as well. So they're mismanaging the economy like anything. Imran Khan, once he was removed, he said that, listen, don't remove me. Because I told Imran Khan before the regime change operation that there are plans to remove you. But he said, if they remove me, well, the economy would be, you know, it'll really go down the drains. So I really wanted to tell him at that time. But Imran Khan, if you know him, once he's made his mind, he rarely listens to anyone. He said, well, you know, there is no way they can remove my government, but they won't be able to control the economy. Well, they don't care about the economy. They only care about themselves, their personal interests.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think that they're prepared to throw their own people under the bus for their own ambitions.
Yeah, that's true. So in the context of great power rivalry, now the Baloch Liberation Army, they're being funded by the Indians. They are taking protection money from the Chinese. They are getting their weapons from Afghanistan. Of course, they've got a lot of money because they are taking protection money from the drug lords who upstick from Afghanistan into Pakistan. They're taking the protection money from oil smuggling, and there's institutionalized oil smuggling from Iran into Pakistan under the Pakistani military. And I've provided proof of it. I've proved it on my ex articles. My ex account is at Soldier Speaks, so you can find those under the articles. There are documentary evidence which tells you all that. So they've got no shortage of money. And if you've got enough money, you can buy any kind of Russian weapons from the weapon depots in Afghanistan and support the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. You can go in. And the Pakistani military has already made an enemy out of Afghanistan because they are now very careful in criticizing the Indians because they are an economic giant in the strategic partnership with the U.S. and the present government regime in Pakistan, who has been superimposed on the country. After Imran Khan won the election, and there are election rigging allegations which have been, you know, validated by statements by the British Prime Minister. David Cameron gave a statement about it, and there was a statement by the US Secretary of State as well. And of course, the European Union do not want to release the detailed report because they know there is a lot of election rigging which went in the February 2024 elections. But since the Pakistani military is supplying ammunition to the Ukraine war for the vintage arms which are there, the vintage weapons which are there, with ammunition, making ammunition for which is not very profitable, it has been outsourced to the Pakistani ordnance factories. So they are selling it through, they were initially selling it through the UK, and they're still selling it to the UK, but they are selling ammunition, the air bridge to lift that ammunition from Pakistan, Islamabad, up till Ukraine through Kosovo has been established by the UK. And so that's why the Europeans didn't really wanted to speak against the election rigging, and the British, they were quiet about it. So yeah, that's there. Yeah.
Yeah. So the latest we've seen really in geopolitics is this apparent split between the Americans and the British, with the British wanting to carry on the war with the Russians in Ukraine. We kind of think we're all grown men. We can talk about the proxy war, because the Ukraine as a country has suffered horribly over this, and Zelensky himself is not really, you know, you couldn't say he's in charge. He's a former comedian who was an actor, so what do you make of the Donald Trump pulling back from the support for the Ukraine war, the financial support, and now pushing, actually working very closely with the Russians to get an end to this?
Yeah, as far as the Americans are concerned, Donald Trump is looking after the national interest of the U.S., which simply cannot afford this war anymore if they want to survive. It's very simple. It's as simple as that. So they really cannot keep on funding Europe. I mean, they've been funding after Marshall Plan, and after they've been bearing paying for the maximum share of defending Europe. Why should they? That's what they asked. So they're easing America first, which, you know, does make a lot of sense. And as far as the so-called UK and the US rivalry is concerned, I don't believe in that. I believe, well, there's this book by Tim Marshall. It's called The Power of Geography. If you read that book, it's a 2 years old book. If you read that book, and I go by the same school of thought, it's very realistic, you know, and that is the same school of thought which explains that in the post-Second World War era, once the British Empire crumbled, and the British took the U.S. naval ships and gave them their global bases to the U.S. Navy and to the U.S., so that exchange took place, so the balance of power definitely shifted. So after that, the UK has been, you know, extending, became a bridge between the US power and their former colonies and their zones of influences. In the post-Brexit world order, I won't go into the details, but in the post-Brexit world order, the UK has to maintain the same special relationship with the US, and has to be a bridge between the US and rest of the world, which it has got influence, which is it has got soft power, because English is, you know, the most spoken language in the world. And that gives them a lot of soft power. So they are leveraging that soft power and leveraging being a bridge between the US and the rest of the world to keep themselves amongst the top economies of the world. Because if they're not going to be able to do that, they won't be able to pay the bills, as we were talking earlier. And they won't be able to keep the Scots happy or the Irish happy. And, well, they want to leave them. They're only in it because, you know, you're amongst the top 10 economies because of the economic benefit. Let's be honest about it. So if you are unable to maintain yourself amongst the top economies of the world, and if you're not making enough money, and how do you make enough money? By getting, you know, favorable trade deals. So to get favorable trade deals in the post-Brexit world order, you need to have a close relationship with Europe, which you've got already with the E3, Germany, France, and you've got a good relationship with Scandinavia. Then through Poland, you've also gained influence into the Eastern Europe, and you're supporting Ukraine war, the British, because you want to hold in that part of the world, which is the food bread basket of Europe, mind you. So you do need favorable, I mean, you're part of the Quad, and you've got a blue water navy, and you want to be part of the Western US-led alliance in the Indo-Pacific to counter the Chinese. But at the same time, those are defense alliances. All what you're doing over there is spending the money. You've got to make the money, and you can make the money through access to local markets. And, well, your local markets are maximum up to South Asia. You need access to Indian market, to the Pakistani. I don't know. There's nothing much going on over there. But you want to do trade with China, you really cannot, you know, you really cannot go against them quite openly, because, you know, your own energy sector is being funded by the Chinese investment. And we know the entire saga, how it went. So I won't go into the details over there. But to cut the long story short, the UK has successfully established zones of influences around the world, particularly in areas where the US has not been able to. And what Donald Trump did to Zelensky and Ukrainians proved to be a blessing in disguise for the British. Now they've got a zone of influence in Europe because the vacuum left by the US, by Trump administration policy, have been filled by the British government, by Keir Starmer's government. He's talking to, you know, as soon as Zelensky was kicked out from the White House, he came whining to London, right? And then all the global leaders, including Justin Trudeau, was called here in the UK, in London. And, Keir Starmer, you know, really showed, the British actually showed that we still have got this kind of zone of influence. So they're
That didn't really seem to achieve anything, did it? There was a lot of fuss, a lot of fuss potting around. But there's nobody apart from maybe the French that want to put any boots on the ground against the Russians, because they know that this is an unwinnable war against Russia.
Tony, perception is much more important than reality in this world we live in. And the markets are made and shaped. Trade is done based on perception. So the perception is that, well, the British are, you know, the power brokers, and they've got a special relationship going on with the US, which is true, actually. So they are using that perception, and they are trying to be the bridge between the US influence to their so-called zones of influence, like in Pakistan. The Pakistani, you know, the British High Commissioner to Pakistan, Jane Marriott, and the kind of influence she's got over there. And the Pakistani Army Chief, he's a dictator, but he came here and he was given the Horse Guards ceremonial salute.
You're quite right. I mean, this is what they call optics, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what optics is. And they will tell the Americans, well, if let us handle it for you. And they will handle it for them on their own terms. And by doing so, they can, you know, they'll get access to the kind of leverage which will allow them to make favorable trade deal for themselves. And the perception will keep the London, city of London at top, which it is already, and the British aristocracy, you know, happy, and the British economy actually at the top. And that will keep Scotland, the United Kingdom, intact. If today Scotland goes for independence, and there are streaks in there, what are you going to do with your deep water submarine base? There is only one nuclear submarine base, and that's in Scotland. What are you going to do with that?
You'll probably have to buy that little bit of Scotland off of the Scots. Look, finally, can you just give us a little bit of hope, I hope, in Pakistan as to whether it's, do you think it's possible, it's feasible that Imran Khan or somebody like him might actually get so that the people can rule there rather than just the military, as has happened for most of the time since independence?
Tony, the only hope for Pakistan is Imran Khan, because irrespective of all the suppression, all the fascism by the military, people came out in droves on the 8th February 2024 and voted for him. And he, instead of being the head of government, is thrown in the jail. So that is the only hope. If you want to keep the Federation of Pakistan intact, and if you want to have a future for Pakistan, you have to give the mandate of the public back to the public representative. There is no other way. There's no other way around it. Other way around it is what's happening right now. Train full of military soldiers getting hijacked. Have you ever heard about it? And hundreds of soldiers getting killed. And there were only three insurgents, the BLA terrorists, which got killed. There are more than 100 soldiers, the Pakistani military soldiers, that got killed. So this kind of ratio, casualty ratio, and then the Pakistani military do not simply have the kind of force to, you know, hold the ground if it goes south, and it is going south. So to keep it on tracks, you have to bring the public mandate back, and you have to.
I mean, it might sound an exaggeration, but if they're not careful in Pakistan, it could end up like somewhere like Libya or Syria is now, with the death squads wandering around.
It's already happening in Balochistan. There are government death squads roaming in Balochistan who wants to maintain the writ of the government. There are extremist elements, religious fundamentalist extremist elements, organization banned by the US, like BLA is banned in the Western world by the US and UK as a terrorist outfit. There are other terrorist outfits like Lashkar-e-Jhangvi that is being financed and supported by the military to, you know, act as their proxies. And the Pakistanis have been working through proxies. Even in Balochistan, there is ISK, which is working as ISI's proxy. And I've got evidence to it in some other episode. I can present it to you as well. So it is already, you know, the situation is pretty, pretty dangerous, because it's a nuclear country. And of course, all the assets, the nuclear assets, are safe. They're in Punjab mostly, and they're very well guarded. But what are you going to do with them? You can't nuke your own country. You can't really use strategic weapons against in a conventional war. And the BLA terrorists or insurgents, whatsoever you may like to call them, one man's freedom terrorist and another man's freedom fighter. So what doesn't matter what you call them, they've proven themselves to be very effective, and they've got their tactics have improved marvelously. Once I'm speaking as a military man, their tactics are superior, far superior. There are guerrilla tactics, fine, but their tactics are superior. They're holding the ground. The Pakistani forces are restricted to the cantonments and the fortifications. And on ground, they do not hold Balochistan anymore. And next week, the Trump administration's business group, you know, the American investors are going there, and they want to pitch the Balochistan mineral wealth to the American investors. Well, what's happened today? I don't think the Americans, there is an American advisory, the government State Department advisory, specifically telling the American citizens, and of course, the UK government has also issued the same, not to travel to Pakistan in these particular areas where they're pitching investment opportunities. So, of course, it is very bad. The situation is bad. And in the context of this,
well, it is, isn't it? It does make you wonder whether maybe the Chinese and others have been funding this little revolutionary army to make sure that the Americans don't choose to invest their money there.
Yeah. Knowing BLA, knowing the way they operate, as a journalist now, I communicate with them as well. And I've got their pulse as well. My main sources are in my own military, because of which I'm giving them the tough time. They really hate me for it, but I'm doing my investigative journalism. But what I know is that they're taking help from anyone. They're taking protection money from the Chinese, and they're in communication with the Chinese MSS, Ministry of State Security. That's the Chinese intelligence, which is opening a base in Karachi, by the way, to control the entire coastal belt there, Pakistan's coastal belt from Karachi. And that is why Americans are interested. They want to counter that. But they're also in communication with Americans through Indians, because India is in a strategic partnership with the US. So they're taking money off them as well, and they are taking weapons and equipment off them as well. So yeah, they're in communication with anyone who's willing to help them to, you know, get a separate country for themselves. They're even, you know, they've struck a deal around 4 decades ago. A demographic change was introduced in Balochistan, where the Pakhtuns or the Pashtuns were introduced to Balochistan, so that the demography of Balochistan could be changed to support the Pakistani Federation. But even those people are now either they're supporting the Baloch people, the Baloch Liberation Army, or at the same time they are scared, or they're scared of them. And just like Ireland, Irish Republican Army was the armed wing of their independence. There was Sinn Féin, and same way there is a political organization led by Mahrang Baloch, who's been nominated for Nobel Peace Prize just now. That is, they say we're not associated with BLA, but that is not true. They are the political wing of this separatist movement, or they call themselves the freedom movement. So they're very well organized, and everything has happened because the Pakistani military policies facilitated the birth of the terrorists. Once you killed a guy in front of his kids, once your fighting strategy is based on the fighting strategy of British in the colonial era, where you are laying siege to an entire village or entire town, and you're pounding it with artillery ammunition for 3-4 days, and then you're going in with tanks at your flanks and Cobra gunship helicopters flying over you, and you shoot at anything which moves, you kill children, you kill women, you kill the elderly, and their men, able men, are watching all of it from the mountains above. So they pledge their lives to fight the state, and they're warrior tribes. They'll fight you. So you are facilitating your policies, your age-old policies are facilitating the birth of these terrorists. So how
you're
can
right.
you blame
Well, I mean, them? You're quite right. I think it's a good comparison with Northern Ireland. And also, of course, looking at Gaza too, the way that the Hamas have got loads and loads of recruits. And never mind trying to eliminate Hamas. What you've done is you've given them a great big boost by committing these war crimes. Anyway, look, fascinating chat, Adil. Can you let our listeners know how they can find you and follow you?
Yeah, I'm available on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Soldier Speaks. It's SoldierSpeaks. There are no spaces in it. At Soldier Speaks, you'll find me on X, formerly Twitter. That's my mainstay. And then the same at Soldier Speaks, I'm on Patreon.com, where I do my regular vlogs as well. And I do my live stream on X, and they're also on twitch.tv with the same handle at Soldier Speaks. And I'm on Rumble. It's again not at Soldier Speaks. That's where I do. But those programs are mostly in English, but I've been doing in Urdu, sorry. But off and on, I do my English live streams as well. This is one such occasion, and mostly there with George Galloway, whenever he invites me. But now I'll try to make it a regular feature, maybe with Tony, inviting Tony.
careful, mate, careful. Look, I just think it's fascinating, particularly maybe we could just finally, you could say something about how you had so many views by the Pakistani population, and then somebody came along and pulled out the rug from underneath you.
Yeah, Tony. Well, after I escaped to the UK, I was advised by my followers on X, formerly Twitter, to open a YouTube channel. So I did open it. And within 3 weeks, I had around 600,000 followers, and I had around 1 million views per day. That was a lot. And I used to do live stream, which will attract around 100,000 live audience. So that was really bothering them. So then the Pakistani state, through their troll factories, started mass reporting me. But that really didn't make a difference until the Pakistani government went to Google, and they went to their American partners as well. And they told them that if you're not going to shut him down, if you're not going to find a way, so we will definitely put YouTube down in Pakistan. And they had already done that before, so it was a real threat. So I think, in my own opinion, it is a business decision by Google to, you know, terminate my channel. And that's about it, actually. Because the kind
so
of
is it really possible for the Pakistani military to close down an entire part of social media?
Oh, yeah, they have banned, because of me, they have banned X in Pakistan, and you can only access it through VPN. And because I've got my sources serving army officers and serving ISI officers, and they're not very happy with the situation. They're patriots. They don't want Pakistan to break away. They don't want the Balkanization of Pakistan. So they give me, I've always exposed the best laid plans through my sources. So they don't want it to come out, not to the Pakistani audience in particular. So they told X to, you know, terminate. But since I've got about 1.6 6.5 million followers on X, so it's not very easy, I think. So X did not oblige, and X have been banned in Pakistan, a market of 250 million people. It is banned, and now X is sort of a symbol of resistance in that country, because people use VPN to access it, and even the Pakistani intelligence agencies get their news from X. Like in yesterday's incident in Balochistan, after every big terrorist incident, they lift the ban for the time being, and they open up X so that their own intelligence agencies could get intelligence. But normally what they do is that even they slow down the internet. They've got a Chinese firewall installed recently to silence the dissent in Pakistan. And the Chinese firewall cost a lot, really. It took a cost of around $25 million. But there's a lot of corruption charges, and there are investigations going on, because that firewall really messed up the entire information technology infrastructure of the country. And there were a lot of business losses, and there still are. And the only way they can still, you know, control the X is by you know, slowing down the internet after the working hours, so that the VPN could not connect. And if the VPN is not connecting, you cannot connect with X. So yeah, there is a lot of censorship on the Chinese model, and that is why it is more important for me to expose all this. And I am doing that. I'm doing that as a journalist now. I've been fighting with a gun before, and now I'm fighting with my pen, with your fellow member as a National Union of Journalists. I'm doing whatever I can, and I'm fighting back.
Adil Raja, thanks very much for joining us. Hope to speak to you again.
Thank you, Tony.